Okay, so today we're going to look at Virginia Woolf, and of course, on this day when we commemorate the war, one of the things that's obviously pertinent and relevant to our consideration of Mrs. Dalloway is the fact that one of our central characters, Septimus Smith, is a war veteran who has been severely affected by the war. And there are references in the novel, not many, but they're present to the after effects of the First World War as perceived in the London of the 1920s that Woolfe is talking about. So that's my outline for today. I want to obviously introduce Virginia Woolf today, say something about her life and how it affected her writing, to try and establish her as a modernist novelist, and also to say something about her as a critic, because I think we've said right at the beginning that all of our writers, pretty much, are not just novelists and poets, they're also critics, they're also taking part in the intellectual debates of the time, and all of that helps to mould and to define what modernism is. So it's important that we try and look at that, I think. And of course, Virginia Woolf is a towering figure in modernism. She's one of the central figures. She is usually, I think, one of the few women that courses like this look at. The modernist landscape, if you like, tends to be dominated by what Lewis called the men of 1914, by which he meant people like Eliot, Pound himself, of course, James Joyce, and so on. And men of 1914, not women. But Woolfe is a very significant figure, not just in the development of the modernist novel, but in the development of a modernist sensibility. So, there she is as a young woman, looking rather beautiful. She is born in 1882, so she's another Victorian. And it's interesting, I think, when we think about our modernists, how many of them are born and raised and brought up at the height of, maybe, you know, slightly late, but nonetheless, you know, in the full confidence, if you like, of the Victorian era. At the height of empire, with a stable leader and you know, much respected monarch in charge of the country and the empire. And I suppose that puts into context the size of the thing that these modernists were rebelling against. She is the daughter of Leslie Stephen, who is a leading figure as a writer and as a critic and as somebody who's involved in the creation of the Oxford English Dictionary. So he's what in old-fashioned terms might be called a man of letters. So she's brought up in quite an intellectual household with her brothers. But unlike her brothers, who get sent off to Oxford, I think it was, she is educated at home. Why? Well, it's obvious, isn't it? She's a woman, so she doesn't get to go to university. And so even, you know, even in the household of a fairly enlightened man, who obviously valued education, she's not considered to be worthy enough to be sent off anywhere, actually, to be educated. So that's curious, I think. But nonetheless, she develops very quickly in the early part of the 20th century, and she is the leading figure, the linchpin, if you like, the central person within what becomes known as the Bloomsbury Group. And the Bloomsbury Group, I'll mention it a bit further into the lecture. But the Bloomsbury Group is important, I think, not just in terms of the individual careers of the people involved in it, but again, in that idea of creating a type of sensibility, a type of atmosphere and environment, if you like, within which the challenges to the accepted status quo in the arts and literature could thrive. So I can't stress enough, I think, how important she is in all of that development as we go through the early part of the 20th century, the first 25 to 30 years. One thing which characterises Virginia Woolf's early life is mental illness. And it's perhaps rather obviously significant that her first breakdown comes in 1895 when her mother dies, and her second when her father dies. So from 1904 she is an orphan, so she's a young woman without parents at that stage, and each death occasions some kind of mental breakdown, which ends up with her being hospitalised, and then she comes out to sort of pick up the reins. But she's always, throughout her life, subject to that kind of pressure, I think. During that time, she attempted suicide and was institutionalised as a result. So it's a troubled early development in terms of her life that we can see there. And I suppose a question that you might ask if you're studying Mrs. Dalloway is, well, what's the relevance of this? You know, okay, she was very troubled and she attempted suicide, and that's very sad, but we're here to study the text. And I think that's a reasonable point. I'm not a great fan of putting too much emphasis on the biography of writers as a way of leading your insight into their text. On the other hand, I think it's fair to say that when you read Virginia Woolf's works, there's often a startling presence in those works, which is to do with emotional states and to do with extreme emotional states. So, for example, Septimus Smith would be the obvious one in Mrs. Dalloway. And you can't help feeling that perhaps derives from her own experience of those kind of extremes. I'll just leave that with you. You know, is this relevant? Well, it might be. And as I say, I don't want to... and certainly if you were writing about Woolf, I don't think it would be a great idea to spend ages writing about her biography when you're supposed to be analysing the text. But I think perhaps at the back of your mind is, you know, is that sense that she perhaps does have an insight into these things. Okay, so I'm going to say something about her development as a writer in her early years now. And this is really to do with the development of the Bloomsbury Group and the development of a kind of approach to literature and the arts that developed as a result of those meetings. She is from an early age, and it's interesting, I suppose, you know, with both the parents dead, she has a certain amount of income, she's comfortably off, and so she is able to kind of indulge her predilection for literature and the arts. And a group begins to develop. Leonard Woolf, who has been a civil servant in the Empire, he was in Sri Lanka, or Ceylon, as it was called in those days. And he's back, and eventually, of course, he marries Virginia. Vanessa is Virginia's sister, and she eventually marries Clyde Bell, which is why she's Vanessa Bell, although that marriage doesn't last very long, and she has a series of relationships with other people, men and women. Lytton Strachey, the author of Eminent Victorians, a historian and critic, and various others. So this becomes the basis of the Bloomsbury Group. And around about 1906, this group starts to meet on a regular basis. You know, they meet up in Bloomsbury, district of London. Not a particularly, at that time, fashionable district of London. Vanessa Bell was actually the instigator of the move to Bloomsbury. And so that area, which is now considered to be very fashionable, the area around the British Museum, Bloomsbury, is a place where this group begins to coalesce, to get together. And what Wolfe does is she writes for the Times Literary Supplement, and she also writes for other journals as well, including some influential ones. Again, those little modernist magazines, which are so important in the development of modernism. So she writes, for example, for the Dial and for Athenaeum. So she's establishing herself actually as a critic and a reviewer before she's establishing herself as a novelist. And in her career, what she identifies as a significant turning point for her is in this famous phrase. This actually rather clumsy phrase, it seems to me, on or about December 1910. Don't know how you can be on December 1910, but anyway. On or about December 1910, human character changed, she said. This is a very portentous statement. It's a very, it's a statement that's kind of loaded with intent and actually a bit of mystery. You know, what was the cataclysmic event that happened in December 1910? That quotation often gets plucked out of context like that, so I want to give it a bit of context. And this is the paragraph that follows that. And in that paragraph, she seems to say that there wasn't a cataclysmic event, there wasn't a sudden change, but what there was some kind of movement, some kind of metamorphosis in the way that people felt. And she says, since one must be arbitrary, let us date it about the year 1910. So that actually qualifies that rather portentous statement quite a bit. What she seems to be suggesting is that there is a change. It's somewhere in 1910, or at least it was for her, in the way that people thought. It's very difficult to say, I think, that human character changed. I don't think human character works like that, I would suggest, but nonetheless, that's what she said. So she's interested then in the effect of external events on the way in which people respond to the world. That little passage is from her essay Mr. Bennet and Mrs. Brown, which she published in 1924. So if we go back to 1910, well, what was happening? Well, a couple of things which I think are quite interesting to draw out in terms of Virginia Woolf's life. So on the left there is a picture taken in 1910. I think it was February, early 1910 anyway. And you can see I've captioned it the Dreadnought Hoax. The Dreadnought Hoax. The Dreadnought was the finest ship of the British Empire, the flagship, if you like, of the British Empire. And it was docked at Greenwich. And what happened in 1910 was that the captain of the ship received a message that the Abyssinian ambassador and his entourage were on their way to visit the ship, and he should make them welcome and show them around the ship. Actually, it wasn't the Abyssinian ambassador at all. It was a man called Horace de Vere Cole, who was a kind of upper-class man about town, a bit of a joker, and some of his friends. including on the left there, on the extreme left, that's Virginia Stephen, or Virginia Woolf, as we know her. So there she is, blacked up with probably some shoe polish or something, a turban on, and some vaguely oriental-looking robes. And the same goes for her pals. Her brother Adrian is in there. I think this is Horace Devere Cole. This is Adrian, I think. Next to them are members of the British Civil Service who facilitated this visit. So, I mean, you can imagine. If you imagine it happening today, you know, that somebody can just kind of bluff their way onto the most cutting-edge bit of military kit that the Empire has. Apparently what they did, they were shown round, and of course they suggested that they couldn't communicate in English, so they used a kind of pig Latin to communicate with each other, which apparently was enough to fool the captain and the crew of the Dreadnought. It's a bizarre little episode, and kind of irrelevant in a way, but I thought it was interesting to show another side of Virginia Woolf that perhaps we don't always consider when we consider this rather depressing and depressed woman. But you know, she was capable of things like that, and it's just a bizarre episode that I thought we should know about anyway. The other big thing that happens in 1910, and I think this is usually the thing that is anchored to Virginia Woolf's statement about human character changing, is the Post-Impressionist exhibition organised by Roger Fry. Roger Fry was a member of the Bloomsbury Group, an art critic, really, was what he did mostly. He'd set up something called the Omega Workshops, which were a kind of design, I suppose we'd call it now, a kind of design consultancy. But one of the, I suppose, perhaps the most important thing that he ever did, really, was to organise this Post-Impressionist exhibition, which took place in the Grafton Gallery in London. And I've used that image there, that's Van Gogh's Starry Night, as an example, because that's one of the pictures that was exhibited there. Now, the interesting thing, I think, from our point of view, we're thinking about the modernists as kind of revolutionary at the beginning of the 20th century and doing things which people hadn't done before. Then one of the ways in which sensibility shifted, not just in terms of art, but in terms of all other forms of artistic expression, was this discovery of the Post-Impressionists. Now, the exhibition was people like Van Gogh and Gauguin and Manet, people like that, who actually, if you know your art history, were 30 years previous to 1910. You know, they were late 19th century artists. So this kind of stuff had been current in Europe for quite some time before Roger Fry put these up in London and caused quite a sensation. And if you look at some of the critical response to the Post-Impressionist exhibition, quite a lot of it is on the sort of level of, oh, these artists can't paint, you know, this is rubbish, how can this possibly be considered to be art? You know, those kinds of rather ignorant, rather philistine responses that we're perhaps used to with modern art. So it was an important event, and it did change the way a lot of people thought about art. And certainly when you read the diaries and the journals and the letters of people involved at the time, it comes up a lot as a life-changing moment for a lot of them. It changes their perspective. So that's usually what is thought of as the big thing in December 1910, as far as Woolf is concerned. One thing I think that it does do is that whatever else you think about the paintings of people like Van Gogh and so on, is that they're moving away from a strictly pictorial representation of life, and they're moving towards something which is much more, well, impressionistic, shall we say, post-impressionistic, especially what comes later on, and you find, you know, the development of things like cubism, for example, with people like Picasso and Braque. So you're getting a big change from the idea of art as something that has to, you know, almost photographically reproduce something, a person, a landscape, whatever it might be, to something which is much more about expressing a mood or expressing an emotion, and not necessarily paying attention to the exact representation of whatever it is that's caused that emotion. And that seems to me to spill over very much into literature, where the idea, and this is something we'll explore in a minute in Virginia Woolf's criticism, the idea is not necessarily to say, here is exactly how something is or was, but rather to suggest in a much more nuanced way what a particular emotion might be like, and to explore that rather than to say something in great external detail. Okay, so that's really in the way of background and environment and atmosphere, the kind of intellectual landscape of the time. I want to move on now to say something more specific about Woolf's development as a novelist. So if we think about Woolf developing, her first novel is The Voyage Out, 1915, which is very autobiographical, I think it's fair to say. Features a central female character who is very like Woolf. Night and Day seems to be almost a backward step. It seems to be much more conventional. And then in the 1920s, she gets into her stride. So 1922, the big year of modernism, her contribution to that is Jacob's Room, which is a very kind of intense novel, which perhaps surprisingly is entirely about Jacob's Room. And then, of course, Mrs. Dalloway in 1925, but probably set in 1922. And then To the Lighthouse in 1927. And I think it's fair to say that Mrs. Dalloway and To the Lighthouse would be labelled as major modernist texts. Why? Because they show those characteristics that we've been talking about on our module. Mrs. Dalloway, which we'll go into more detail in a minute, partly because of its the way it manipulates time, partly because of the ideas that it exposes, the way in which it uses the interior thoughts of characters as a central means by which the narrative is conveyed. To the Lighthouse does similar things and has perhaps an even more radical way of approaching narrative time. So in To the Lighthouse, for example, the first, getting on for half the novel, takes place over a few hours at a dinner party. And then you get a very short section in the middle, which collapses a number of years into a few short paragraphs. And actually, all of the major life events, if you like, marriages, deaths, etc., they happen in that very short passage. And then the final passage takes place 10 years later, when the lighthouse of the title is finally reached by one of the characters. So what you have then is two parts, the first and the third part, which are very small amounts of time in terms of hours expended, but in terms of pages in the book, you know, by far the majority of the book. And then a middle section where there's apparently a lot of what you might think of as traditional action over a period of time, and that's compressed into a few pages. And that playing about with time is something which she does a lot, and something that we'll come back to next week as well. So that's her development in the 20s as a novelist. I just want to say something about her development as a critic as well, because that's happening in parallel to her development as a novelist. And what's clear when you read the key texts, such as this one, Modern Fiction, Mr. Bennet and Mrs. Brown, and various other essays that she's writing about that time, is that she's trying to identify what it is that is going to crystallise her ideas about how to convey life on the page. And she's rejecting virtually everything that comes before. She's rejecting the conventions of the novel in order to develop something which is much different. So, this is how she puts it here, that she says, at this moment, the form of fiction most in vogue, by which she means the kind of traditional novel as practiced by people like Arnold Bennett, the form of fiction most in vogue more often misses than secures the thing we seek. Now, this is a key point. What is it that she seeks as a novelist? Well, according to her, it's the life or spirit, the truth or reality, the essential thing. And I think that's necessarily rather vague. She doesn't quite know how to express it. But what she's suggesting is she wants to convey life as it's lived. Now, to me, actually, this is, you know, personally, it seems to me, that's a kind of completely futile thing to try and do, because life as we experience it is so complex that I think it's impossible to put everything down on a page. But nonetheless, this is the kind of thing that Woolf is trying to do, and I think that Joyce is trying to do in Ulysses as well. So she wants to cast off what she calls the ill-fitting vestments of the traditional novel. She wants to get rid of that completely. Because, you know, it's I suppose in the modern jargon it would be, it's not fit for purpose, according to her. So she despairs that we go on perseveringly churning out these novel-length bits of prose, 230 chapters. Her solution, of course, is this famous passage about the ordinary mind on the ordinary day. And we've quoted this before, so you know, you're probably familiar with it already. But it is actually the key to her approach. This is what she's trying to do in her writing. She talks about the myriad impressions that rain in on a mind on an ordinary day. And she sees that her job is to try to represent those subtle changes in the way that people respond, the way that people feel themselves, the way that people represent themselves in life. She's not interested, and she says this very plainly, she's not interested in plot, she's not interested in neat endings, she's not interested in some kind of moral message to come at the end of her novel. She's interested in representing life as it's lived by ordinary people with all those myriad impressions falling in on them. She goes on to qualify that by suggesting that life is this very, it's a very evocative phrase, isn't it? A luminous halo, a semi-transparent envelope surrounding us. Rather difficult to visualise, but you know, that sense that life is something very fluid that we're moving through, that somehow surrounds us. She asks the rhetorical question, to which the answer, as far as she's concerned, of course, is yes. Is it not the task of the novelist to convey this spirit, whatever it is, with as little mixture of the alien and external as possible? She wants to convey that sense of the thing that we are enveloped in, this life that we're living as we live it. That's what her motive, that's what the impulse is when she wants to write. So it's, as I say, it seems to me almost impossible. No, actually not almost impossible, completely impossible to do that. But nonetheless, that's her motivation. That's what she's aiming to do. And I think when we're looking at any of her work, that's what we've got to keep in mind. You know, her objective is to convey that sense of life as it's lived. Now, whether she's successful or not in doing that is up to you to decide. But that's certainly, I think, where you need to start from. Okay, so that's, well, we will return to say a bit more about Virginia Woolf as a critic next week, but that's a very good kind of statement of intent. You know, if you're looking for a manifesto for the modernist novel, then that's pretty well it. You know, that's what Virginia Woolf says it should be. That's the task of the novelist as far as she's concerned. We'll look a bit further into this in seminars. So moving on to say a bit more about Mrs. Dalloway. Maybe one of the key things that you need to consider when you're looking at Mrs. Dalloway is the title. Titles are always significant, it seems to me. And the central character in Mrs. Dalloway is Clarissa Dalloway. But the novel isn't called Clarissa. Maybe because that title was already taken by Richardson, I don't know. But it's called Mrs. Dalloway, so she's defined by the Mrs., isn't she? She is the wife of a Conservative MP, and the novel takes place in London and includes lots of references to the Houses of Parliament, Big Ben, so it's that sort of area that we're in. The novel takes place on one day, in terms of its action. It ranges, as we'll see, it ranges back and forth over a very wide period of time. But the events, such as they are, of the novel, take place on one day. So in that sense, and probably in the only sense, actually, it's comparable to Ulysses. We have, in Ulysses, a June day at the beginning of the century, and in Mrs. Dalloway we have a June day a few years later, 15, 16 years later. And obviously, as with 18th century novels, which tend to be called the name of the central character, Mrs. Dalloway is the central character here, but the narrative doesn't centre solely on her. And in fact, there's a dual narrative, isn't there? Because we have the day as it unfolds of Mrs. Dalloway, and we also have the day as it unfolds of Septimus Smith, the war veteran. So, and their two paths barely intersect at all. They do intersect. They actually, if we're talking about paths intersecting, then there is a moment where literally their paths intersect, not thinking in metaphorical terms, but thinking about, you know, geographical terms on the ground, their paths intersect. And their lives just about intersect because the doctor who is treating Septimus Smith is also a doctor known to Mrs. Dalloway. But apart from that, you know, these two characters are completely separate. The focus of the narrative is apparently on something that, in most people's eyes, is a relatively trivial thing. Mrs. Dalloway is having a party. She's known for having her parties. She's a Westminster hostess. People go to her parties. You know, she's a figure there. So she's planning for one of her parties. But that's it. You know, and if you think about, as far as Mrs. Dalloway is concerned, if you had to identify the external events of the day, or the external events of the novel, that's the same thing, what happens? Well, Mrs. Dalloway prepares for a party. She prepares for it by buying flowers and doing various other errands, and then going back to her house, where people start to arrive, and the party happens, and we see her at the end, on a sofa, the party's finished, or is about to finish, and the novel closes. But within that, the range is actually extraordinary and takes in all kinds of issues which are of obviously much more importance than just preparing for a society do. The aftermath of war, particularly, the stories, there are interior hints to suggest that the story is set in 1922, it's published in 1925, certainly the early 20s. So, very soon after the conclusion of the First World War. And obviously, the fact that it features somebody who's been severely affected by the First World War, the soldier Septimus, then that's a key issue in the novel. It also focuses to some extent on empire, on power, on the role of a ruling class, those sorts of things, and also on the same kind of theme really, but on a more social level, the social class the social class issues that are prominent at the time. And I think some historical context is worth pointing out here, that in the 1920s we are moving towards a depression in terms of the economy, which is going to really hit in 1929, the great crash of 1929. So unemployment is rising. You've got the aftermath of war to deal with. The returning soldiers have perhaps not got jobs. There's a lot of soldiers who are disabled as a result of the war. And of course, a lot of soldiers who are dead. And this is before the welfare state, remember. So there isn't that kind of support network for those returning soldiers. And of course, she's writing this in 1925. 1926, a year later, is the only time in this country where we've had a general strike, where everybody, all working people, stopped work for a period of about 10 days, I think, in 1926. And you've got the army on the streets, you've got sort of revolution in the air. So, there are matters of serious social concern in the background all the time, I think, in Mrs. Dalloway. If we think of Mrs. Dalloway in terms of its modernist credentials, then I think there are a few things that we can pick out. We'll obviously go into more detail in coming classes and in the lecture next week. The key thing, I think, is the use of interior monologue. And I want to distinguish that from stream of consciousness. I think it's important that we try to think clearly about this. Stream of consciousness, in my view, is what you get in Ulysses, particularly in Molly Bloom's soliloquy at the end, in the final section of Ulysses, where syntax breaks down, grammar breaks down, punctuation breaks down, and you've just got, literally, a stream of consciousness. Whereas interior monologue tends to dispense with a lot of the usual signposts that you might see, that it occurred to her, she thought, those kinds of signposts about to frame the thought that's being expressed, but nonetheless is usually relatively straightforward in terms of punctuation, grammar, syntax, and so on. Mrs. Dalloway tends to operate on that level, so that we move lightly from and fluidly from Clarissa Dalloway's thoughts to the thoughts of somebody else. I think one of the tricks of reading the novel is that you have to be agile and aware of who's saying something at any particular point. Whose consciousness are you in? Very often you're in Clarissa Dalloway's consciousness, but you move to her returning friend Peter, for example. When she meets him, we move into his consciousness, and then we move fluidly out of that to somebody else's, and so on. The lack of linearity. The novel, you could say, has a perfectly linear structure. We start in the morning. Mrs. Dalloway gets up, she starts thinking about her party, and she goes out to buy flowers. So we start in the morning, and we move through the day. So there is linearity in the sense of a chronological narrative. And that chronological narrative is signalled by references to the time, usually to Big Ben. So we know where we are in the day, and we move forward chronologically. But that idea of time elapsing is only on one level, and time is delved into in very different ways, often based on a series of images. So right at the start of the novel, for example, she thinks about the door that she's going to have to take off its hinges for the party, you know, to allow people to mill about at the party. And that takes her back to a similar door at Boughton 20-odd years ago when she met her husband. So those kind of visual cues are very important in the novel, and they seem to suggest other thoughts as the novel progresses. The idea of fragmentation, a very modernist idea. The novel represents a world undergoing change, as I've just mentioned. And there's also that sense of spiritual disintegration as well, lack of belief. And certainly, if you read carefully some of the passages in the novel, there is a suggestion of a kind of rejection of standard Christian belief in favour of something much more atheist, I suppose. And you've also got not just a single narrative. As I mentioned, you've got Mrs. Dalloway's narrative and Septimus's world. And Mrs. Dalloway's, because she's successful, she's the wife of an MP, she moves smoothly through her world. There's a very sharp contrast between that and the fractured and broken world of Septimus. Okay, so a few more modernist features then. There's a lack of chronological time, as I said, because we move from various timescales all over the place. But Big Ben, at the centre of London, at the centre, therefore, of empire, is constantly referred to. You can only go a few pages without hearing something about Big Ben chiming out the hours. So that's important, and we'll return to that next week. We've also got a series of moments of insight and moments of vision. Mrs. Dalloway has them, and she remembers them in the past. Peter has them. Septimus has them. So these are like Joyce's epiphanies. These moments of insight that suddenly happen, which define how you perceive something, how life is being expressed to you at the time. The concentration on female consciousness, because Mrs. Dalloway is a central character, and also her daughter is important in the way that she perceives things. That's modernist, I think. And the use of prolepsis and analepsis, in other words, the flash forward and the flash back, rather than just sticking with the chronological unfolding of plot. That mixture of the two. So we're moving in a kind of unpredictable way, backwards and forwards in time. Time, then, as a theme, and we'll return to this next week as well, I just want to set it up now. It's emphasised throughout. It's a thing which literally sort of tolls through the novel. And it's perhaps anchored most by the reference to Shakespeare's play Cymbeline, which I'll come to in a minute. The original title of the novel was The Hours, obviously emphasising time, therefore. And that might be significant, mightn't it? That if she's conceiving of the novel as something to do with time, then that might be important. And Bergson, the French theorist, the philosophical theorist of the time, very, very popular theorist of the time. It's impossible to believe that Virginia Woolf wouldn't have come across him. His theories about how we perceive time are very, very current. And again, I'll go into more detail in that next week. But all of those ideas about how we perceive time are very important, I think, within this novel, and say something about how this novel works in modernist terms. Here's a passage from Cymbeline. This is this is when Mrs. Dalloway goes off to get the flowers, and she looks into the window of Hatchard's in central London, and they've got a display, and in the display in the bookshop is this edition of Cymbeline. It's one of those strange late Shakespeare plays, if you don't know it, where he mixes fantasy with comedy and more than a hint of tragedy. And in this scene, two characters come across a recently buried person. And actually, in the play, they mistake who it is. So their grief, which is expressed in these words, is kind of mistaken, because it's not, you know, it's not exactly what they thought it was. And I realise I'm overrunning a bit now, but there doesn't seem to be anybody waiting to come in, so I'm gonna go on and finish in a couple of minutes. The Cymbeline passage then is about how we all are going to come to dust. You know, that familiar idea that however grand or great we are, we're all going to come to dust in the end. So death is a great leveller. So whatever we are, however high or low, all follow this, all come to dust. And that's a thought which reverberates through the novel. So I'm just going to say a little bit about her as a feminist. A Room of One's Own, of course, is the classic feminist text where she posits this idea of Shakespeare's sister. You know, what would Shakespeare's sister's career have been like? Well, the answer, of course, is she wouldn't have had a career because she was a woman. So she puts forward the idea of what's necessary for women to have a kind of artistic life. Later on, in Three Guineas, a few years later, she examines and critiques the whole idea of male domination of culture. And it's particularly significant, I think, because it's clear at that point that we're heading into another war, which profoundly depressed her. And there she is at the end of her life. And she's writing very experimental fiction, which is very difficult to read, actually. If you thought Mrs. Dalloway was a bit of a slog, then you haven't tried The Waves or The Years, which are very difficult. Although, Between the Acts is more accessible, I think. She committed suicide in March 1941. She put a lot of stones into her pockets and walked into a river and drowned, because she just couldn't face life anymore. So, you know, that suicidal tendency, which we mentioned in the early part, is still there, obviously, at the end. So, very brief summary. She's developing a distinctive narrative style, which uses stream of consciousness to a small degree, but mainly interior monologue. She's producing important critiques of the novel and of art. She's also engaging with political issues, and she's focusing on the female condition. So all of those things, I think, make her important in terms of modernism. So I'm sorry to have gone on a bit there. That's all I've got to say, and we'll convene in our classes now. Thank you very much.